Hello, and welcome to this podcast from Consider This. Please let me know what you think and tell others about us on social media. This podcast was originally broadcast live on Northumberland 89.7 FM. You can hear this show live every Friday at noon. Thank you for downloading this program, and I hope you enjoy it. Hello, I'm Robert Washburn, and welcome to Consider This Northumberland, a current affairs program dedicated to the issues facing our community. We talk to the people on the front lines and those behind the scenes who make a difference in your life and Northumberland County. So I'm asking you, the listener, to take some time out of your busy day to consider this.
We have certainly talked to many different people about over the past few weeks about opioids in Northumberland. We've heard from a doctor, a mental health worker, law enforcement, two recovering addicts, and a politician. Their perspectives are provoking, their stories are compelling, and at times heartbreaking. But all have spoken their truth, and we were given incredible insight into what is happening in the community around opioids from those with firsthand knowledge. Today, we hear from yet another perspective. Once again, it is people who work directly with those facing the painful reality of addictions and their complex challenges of helping those individuals. As I'm sure you will hear, opioids are not limited to any one demographic, but transcend all classes, all economic groups, all races, genders, and identities. But my two guests today work with people who face many hardships beyond that, not just addictions, but live in poverty or lack housing or live with mental health problems and a host of other barriers. With me in studio are David Sheffield, Community Director for the Greenwood Coalition in Port Hope, and Nicole Whitmore, Facilitator of the Red Path Addictions Program offered through the Greenwood Coalition. Welcome.
Thanks, Rob.
Thank you.
Nice to be here.
I want to start off with a question I've started off with every group that I've spoken to, and that is, how would you characterize the situation around opioids in Northumberland?
Yeah, it certainly is a difficult situation at the moment. We use the term crisis a lot, and I think some of the responses we're seeing, police responses, emergency responses, that kind of thing, define this as a crisis. This isn't something that just started. This isn't something new. This is a long. I sometimes say that we've designed some of these problems. Our systems have been built so that these are the outcomes, not intentionally, but inadvertently, and so we've created these a crisis like this, and turning it around then is a challenge because the systems that created it are still in place.
One of the things when we use the term crisis, it gets used so many ways and in so many contexts. Sometimes it's hard to really appreciate what you mean by crisis. So, could you take a moment and just help us better understand what you mean when you say we have a crisis around opioids?
Yeah, I guess I would pull out the term crisis when we talk about housing, we talk about opioids, when we're at a point where there aren't solutions that are turning things around, when it feels like we're up against the wall, and that's the way this feels now, that there isn't a simple way to turn this around, and it's affecting. So it's not just affecting a few people that are at the very front of the issue, but it's going through families, it's going through the community, and to different degrees, it's having a wide effect. This isn't 20 people that are suffering a particular thing. This is a whole community that's suffering.
What would you like to add, Nicole?
Well, I think that, unfortunately, it's gotten to the point where, like David was saying, we don't have any, one solution isn't going to help all of the situation. I think that we need a variety of strategic programs and policies in place that can actually help somebody go from A to B instead of kind of what we're seeing right now is there's just a lot of talk and people are asking questions, but we're not actually going to the person that is struggling with the dependency and asking them what they actually need.
So that starts to lead into my next question, which is, what are you seeing as a person who works directly with people with addictions? What is it that you're seeing? Can you paint a picture for us about the things you're seeing day in and day out?
Sure. I think that what I'm seeing is a bunch of people in our community that are suffering from pain. A lot of the substance use comes from an emotional pain, an emotional detachment, some form of trauma that they've been unable to process. And there's various reasons as to what can hinder somebody from processing a trauma. From my own personal experience of what I'm hearing is that, unfortunately, we do have a lack of resources in Northumberland County. Like I was saying, there's not a one-size-fits-all. And unfortunately, we're not able to provide people with options. So here, I'm going to give you different things to consider. And what would you like to try? What do you think will help you go through the door to recovery?
That's really interesting, because when you mentioned that you want what services we have to offer, institutions like to offer things that are specific and that are sort of templated. Here's a template. We're going to do the template. And here's our decision tree. And here's we're going to go. And you'll go here and you go there. And it's that kind of thing. Why is what you're suggesting different from that institutional response? And why are you offering something different or suggesting something different?
Well, I think it's because deep down, a person knows what they need, to succeed. We aren't allowing them to explore that themselves. And this is a societal thing. It's not a county thing, a municipality thing. What we've done is we've relied on institutions so much that we're not giving people the opportunity to say, or to speak up, really, and to say, I've tried this and that doesn't work. We have to understand that we're all human beings. We all have individual needs. We all, what one thing may work for Joe over there, but it's not going to work for, Bob. And we need to understand that it's not a cookie cutter thing, And yes, we're all human beings, but we all are very, very much individuals.
David, is this something that is at the heart of maybe solutions? Is that we tend to look at it institutionally and have our cookie cutters rather than addressing individuals? I just wonder, from your perspective, people might say, well, that's nice to talk that way, but boy, it would be really expensive, and the system would be all over the place. How do we get a program that works like that and as a means towards a solution?
Yeah, I do think it is a bit of a paradigm shift in thinking about some of these needs and how we're going to help folks succeed in the community. Our tendency it has been to look at what's wrong in a community, what's the problem, what's the crisis, and we start by defining that, and then we look for where are the professionals who can address this problem, and we bring them in, and where's the government funding that's going to solve this. A paradigm shift is to recognize that the people involved in this also want to get out of this. They also want to move to a better place. They don't want to die. They want to be healthier, and often they know how to do that. And so to develop relationships of trust that can lead to building solutions isn't necessarily more expensive, but it is responsive to the humanity of those people. And often, this is the reality in institutions where they're built on a consumer model. You got a problem, you can fix it. Here's the way you do it. You build a system. It's got to be uniform. But we're seeing all over the place that those uniform systems are not serving us well, in not just in the helping systems, but in schools, in all sorts of institutions, and so by sort of, you know, kind of that's a top down approach. By looking at the bottom up approach, you can do that. So, and we can offer a range of possibilities without that being expensive necessarily.
All right. Well, on that then, what services does the Greenwood Coalition offer individuals who are facing opioid addictions or having drug addictions?
We like to talk about relationships before services, but the first, and really that's important, that the connection with a person who's struggling, whether it's housing or addiction or something else, making a connection with someone who will listen to them where they're at. So we go into the community, we go to where people are, we don't expect them to come to our office, that kind of thing. And that's really important, and building that bit of trust to begin with. And from there, so in terms of services that we provide, particularly to people with substance dependency, we work with PARN and the health unit to provide harm reduction supplies. So people may be aware of needle exchange and that kind of thing. We distribute naloxone kits and do the training for people to have naloxone kits, which is the antidote for opioid poisoning. And then the Red Path program, which Nicole leads, is another piece of that. And the way that we do outreach, as I said, is based on a relationship, connection, looking at the whole person. This person, we don't meet a person and say, oh, this is a drug addict, this is the approach for that. This is a person, and they may have a drug dependency, but they may have other needs. But we also like to get as quickly as possible to what strengths does this person have, what's working for this person, what can this person do on their own, or what's their goal, what's their dream here.
Before we get talking about Red Path, and I want to spend quite a bit of time on that, I'd like to talk a bit about the things that you've mentioned. So needle programs, just so that our listeners understand, how is that different from a safe injection site, or is it the same thing?
Well, it's definitely not the same thing. We don't provide a space for injection use. But what I do is I provide the tools. So it's not just injection, but it's also inhalation kits. So I will drop off clean supplies. So that can be needles, alcohol swabs, water, tourniquets, filters, all of the things. And that person can also give me a call. I will go and pick up the used supplies and then return them to the appropriate space, which is our local health unit.
So there may be some listeners who would say, like, good Lord, you're facilitating their addiction.
Yeah.
How do you respond to that?
Well, they're going to do it anyways, right? So a person that is using is going to, at times, if they're not given the proper or clean supplies, that they'll reuse. And I speak that from experience. Unfortunately, they'll reuse what they have. So if anything, we're doing our part in, trying to lower the chance of communicable diseases being spread through our community. Not only that, but it's also a way to build trust, to have communication, to begin that rapport of, there's other ways. So maybe this is a start, but to me, that's opening a door to relationship.
Now, in terms of the naloxone kits, there's been some studies done and some concerns raised recently in the media about people taking these kits, and in fact, that we're not helping solve the problem. In fact, we're just, again, it's like the needles, we're simply facilitating. And one of the stories that one of the officers told, they go in and they see six or seven kits, and they're literally overdosing and then bringing themselves back. Is having free naloxone kits a good strategy for dealing with opioids in our community?
Well, is keeping people alive a good strategy in our community? This is a life and death situation, and if somebody goes in and there's a number of used naloxone kits, that should be bringing up a lot of other questions aside from what are the particular habits of those people? Why is this? Why are things at such a desperate state? That suggests a desperation, and that's what we're seeing in the community, that people whose pain is so difficult, who are just trying to get through day to day, that they're willing to take that and to walk that line. These are not people who want to be doing this. This is not some cool thing that they can let me see how close I can get to dying, or see if I can die and come back. And I mean, there may be a few sick people out there pursuing that, but that's not what this is about. This is people so desperate that they'll walk that close to the line, and we need to be looking at what do we do as a community, as a society, to pull people back from that line. Why have we let this get to the point where somebody has to have a kit that's going to keep them alive?
When you're out on the front lines, Nicole, can you share with us maybe some of the stories of the people who you're meeting who are facing these addictions, so that we get a better picture, a clearer picture of who it is in our community who's being affected?
Sure. I'm supporting someone right now and actively using, has had time, some good recovery time, a large chunk actually, quite a few years, and is, like I said, kind of using right now and doesn't want to, wants help, has tried all the things, and is open to trying something different. This person hasn't found the thing that is a fit for them. And I see that every day. There's pain, there's lack of options, there's loneliness, there's isolation, there's shame, there's guilt, there's everything that, you know, outsiders put on them, and yet we feel worse about ourselves. So how do we move forward when we lack the confidence, the strength, is what it feels like, when really you're hopeless day in, day out. And so what I've been doing, what I do is I sit with people, I drink tea with people, I have conversations about all the great things. At times they share all their frustrations because I'm the only person that will listen. And also I'm able to relate. So I validate what they're saying, I provide affirmation. But really what I do is I just listen. And, you know, I don't think I've ever met somebody that has said, no, I don't want help. It's usually, I want help, but I don't know how. I don't know what to do.
Well, that if I can just jump in here, that the idea of having one trusted person in your life who might be your lifeline out, it can't be overlooked. That's such an important piece of this. And we talk about frontline workers and frontline responses and all that kind of thing. The people who are really on the front line are the people who have a drug dependency, the people close to them, and the people who are going to them, and and spending time with them and listening to them. You know, police are at the front line in a very different way. They're not there as workers, as helpers. There are compassionate police officers. Their community policing is improving, but they have a different job there. They're not addiction support workers that are there. And so kind of defining what we mean by frontline workers is really important, that one trusted person that may be your lifeline out is really significant.
One of the things that I know, Nicole, is that you've faced this journey back from an addiction. Would you be able to maybe share a bit of your story?
Sure. I was an opiate addict, heroin addict, cocaine addict, and crack addict. So just a bunch for 8 to 9 years. I was not local my family lived here, but when I was home for a weekend, I was very good at hiding my dependency. I lived in shame from it. I didn't want anyone to know, didn't want to hurt anyone. So I lived hours away, and it was really just a way of escaping. I came home back to Coburg and knew that I needed help. I needed a long-term home or treatment. And in my past, I had tried 12 steps. I had tried short-term rehab, and just nothing really got to the core as to why I was using. And for me, it was that question of why. Why am I like this? Why can't I get better? Why am I not well? Why am I not, you know, able to just have one night of doing cocaine and put it away and go to work and be functional? Why am I dependent? Why is my brain telling me I need this? So I was able to find a place that was a 13-month program. I stayed for 7 months, and really what I was able to do there, so it was a home, it wasn't specifically for drug addiction or substance use, it was a women's only, but I did have a counselor, and she was amazing, and she allowed me just to talk. And I was very hesitant at first. I would only share, you know, just little tidbits, basically just telling her what I thought she wanted to hear, until it got to the point in the program where we were allowed to, I was given options if I wanted to do a 12-step program. And she even said to me, you know, I don't feel like that's a fit. You've done that. And so I started doing some research. And for me, that worked for me. I did research I read everything I could find on addictions, on dependency, early childhood trauma. And so really I just went on this like adventure of like self-discovery. And what I discovered in that was, holy, I'm not processing things that started at a young age. There was lots of trauma that I didn't even realize. And I thought, well, there's no way that something like that trivial could affect me as an adult or as a teenager. But unfortunately, what happened was it started with one trauma, and it just snowballed and got bigger and bigger, and it was just a layer cake, and I had no idea how to set aside or make space in myself to feel emotions. Anytime I felt anything, it just felt like it was the end of the world for me. So the easiest way to not feel was to use something to numb that. Before I knew it, I was, you know, I was lost in substance use, and numbing was basically what I ended up addicted to as well, was running away and not feeling. So when I left the program, what I really learned was how to, I basically had to rewire my whole brain when I was there. I felt like, you know, I didn't know how to wake up in the morning and not be dependent on substances. How do I live a normal, you know, quote unquote life? How do I wake up in the morning and just be okay with being still and with being in such a large world? How am I okay with that? And it took a long time. I stayed 7 months out of a 13-month program. And, you know, I consider myself very lucky. It's been 13 years and I have not had a relapse or a lapse. So I consider them very different. But I knew in my heart that I needed to do something to help others that were suffering the way, in similar ways that I was suffering. And so I went to school and I became an addictions worker. And I really truly feel that, you know, if the best kind of addictions worker or outreach worker or mental health and addictions counselor is a person that can truly relate, whether it's their own personal experience or maybe it's a family member. But if they're able to kind of tune into that, it becomes a very humanizing experience, a very humanizing conversation. And that's what I find. I find that even the majority of the people that I support now, many of them have a vision of, I want to help people. And who knows what that's going to look like, but that's what they want to do.
Thank you for sharing your story. And when we come back, we're going to talk more about that sharing and something called the Red Path Program. We're going to take a break for some commercials. I'm talking to David Sheffield, Community Director for the Greenwood Coalition in Port Hope, and Nicole Whitmore, Facilitator of the Red Path Addictions Program offered through the Greenwood Coalition. Please stay tuned to Consider This on Northumberland 89.7 FM, your truly local source for news. We'll be right back. Hello and welcome back. This is Consider This Northumberland and I'm your host Robert Washburn and you're listening to Northumberland 89.7 FM. My guests today are David Sheffield, Community Director for the Greenwood Coalition in Port Hope, and Nicole Whitmore, Facilitator of the Red Path Addictions Program offered through the Greenwood Coalition. We're talking about opioids. Before we took our break, Nicole, you were talking about the various kinds of programs. You had been through a 7 months of a 13-month addictions program, but you have a very unique program that you offer through the Greenwood Coalition called Red Path. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah. Red Path is very unique. It's Indigenous-inspired, so it focuses on the medicine wheel, the four-room theory, and it's really goes back to or gets to the root of the person's dependency. So it usually ends up so it helps with identifying emotions, connecting, teaches a person how to process emotions, and it's a very sensitive and subtle way of going back to early childhood trauma, and looks at different things like what the environment looked like when, you know, did you see substances around, was there violence, was there abuse, and at different forms. And it's very safe. It's a very safe. It's not a here we're gonna open up all the doors and then, you know, oh, time's up, and now you have all this luggage, you know, that has just been unpacked. And so, like I said, it's a very safe program. It's very subtle, and so it's 21 weeks. And so that usually ends up being about 3 months long. And then there's also a 12-sessioned aftercare portion. One of the things that makes this program really special is that there's elder stories, there's poems, there's a creative arts piece to it as well. Everything is journaled by the participant. So if they're not quite comfortable speaking within the group, that as long as they're getting it out on paper, they're still thinking about it, they're still processing it, they're still allowing memories to come up, and they're putting it somewhere where it's safe and kind of releasing it and letting it go.
Could you maybe, just for listeners who may not be familiar with Indigenous culture, you mentioned the Medicine Wheel, which is the name of a dispensary up on Highway 45.
Right.
We're not talking about that dispensary. Maybe you could talk just a little bit about what is the Medicine Wheel?
Sure. So basically the four-room theory, the Medicine Wheel, it represents that each of us have four rooms. We have an emotional room, we have a physical room, we have a spiritual room, and we have a psychological room. And each day, in order to find balance within ourselves, we need to slowly unpack or take a look and open each of these rooms every day to find harmony and balance in our lives and within ourselves. It's definitely not the dispensary, but thank you for bringing that up.
In an interview, I noticed you were quoted as saying that you're not a counselor, but you walk with people through the program. What does that mean in practical terms?
I'm not giving anyone advice. I don't want to. And I know that most people don't need advice. What they need is, and what I needed was just support. So I will sit with somebody, even if they're under the influence. Sure, I like to encourage them not to use when we're about to sit and chat, but I'm not about to cut our time off. I make space for people, and I make space for people in all sorts of different situations. So I guess I just try to be with people. I don't like the term counselor. I just want to hear someone. I want to feel like, you know, they don't have to hold it all in. I can be an outlet for them.
We know elsewhere in the community there are other programs. Mental health offers programs. You mentioned yourself the 12-step programs. There's all kinds of programs throughout the community. Why do we need this program? Why is this program a significant one to have in Northumberland?
Well, I really believe that it's the fact that it goes to the roots. It goes right to the why is what I like to really call it, because that's how I felt. I had that question and it just hung over me like a dark cloud, was why. And I think that if you're with other folks that are struggling with the same similar situation, that you're with people that are asking the same questions of themselves, that really is just a different approach. It's a let's do this together kind of thing, and let's try to come up with this question. I think that it's a harm reduction option.
What else do we need in the community? I mean, we've talked now about what you offer, and we've talked to many others who offer alternatives. But in going forward and beginning to address this in a serious way, let's start with you, David. What would you like to see on the table?
Yeah, so we talk about this a lot. What are better solutions? And so having more of this informal low threshold kind of approach, like Redpath. Redpath is this self discovery that can be delivered in the community, and it can be multiplied. And so supporting that kind of thing alongside some of the others is important, but also a really key piece. And what really has empowered Nicole's work is the peer support model, somebody who's been there, walking alongside someone else, and when we're looking for solutions in a community, you can't find solutions without also including the people who are living with that struggle. And so if we're going to develop a strategy in Northumberland for moving away from substance dependency, we need the people who are living with that dependency at the table. So we use the term lived experience, but also living experience. Lived experience could be 20 years ago. Living experience knows about what drug is on the street today. And so those are some key pieces. I would say the other thing that I talk about a lot in the community is what the community can do. And when we talk to Nicole, did a great job of explaining what it feels like to be somebody using drugs, the shame and guilt that goes along with that, the isolation, and there are things that we can do as a community to reduce that, to reduce the stigma, to reduce the isolation of people, to stop othering people, to stop calling people who are using drugs these people, to see us as a community that has strengths and needs, and some of us are using drugs and some of us are not. There's not inside and outside. That's one of the biggest barriers to people getting help, is the shame to show up. Even people, families that are that have lost someone to an overdose, experience this shame and guilt and can't talk about it. And that's secondhand shame and guilt, and it's alive and well in communities. And until we start addressing that, we're pushing people more and more to the margins.
I'd like to go back to something that, David said earlier about hearing what people say. Nicole, you're talking to these people directly. What messages are they giving you as to what they need? What are you hearing them saying they need in this community?
Acceptance. They need acceptance. They are walking around and people are avoiding making eye contact. Connection, human connection. When I sit with people, it doesn't matter if I know that they're under the influence, I'll sit with them. How was your day? Ask questions, focus on all the things that they've done right in that day, even though they're clearly unwell in that moment. Like, well, what else did you do today? Because, hey, you look like this has been done, and start lifting people up, but start asking questions in a helpful way and stop pointing fingers. And yeah, just start being compassionate.
You said in an earlier interview that people need to educate themselves about opioids, educate yourself about addiction, educate yourself about the wait times for help in this community, educate yourself about what resources we have. What do you think, either of you can answer this, what do you think we need to know?
Well, I think we need to understand again. We've gone over some of these things several times, but the need for options in the community is really important, and to understand that we have options that are never going to work for some people, and so we need to be making sure that those are available. We also need to understand. You said it at the beginning that this is not a problem of a few people who you might see on the street who might look like they're stoned. This is happening across neighborhoods in communities like Coburg and Port Hope. This is something that's happening in all different kinds of families, and to understand that that this is us, this is who we are, this is our community, this is our society, and not doing this othering.
So we've talked about those things, I agree, but I guess where I'm sitting now is to say, who needs to be at the table to start moving this forward? Or maybe a better question might be, how do we move this forward? What is the next step that has to take place for us to address this?
A great model was recently in Peterborough because of the situation that they're having up there. They organized an opioid summit, and they had 9 members on a panel, and that was extremely well attended. It sold out a couple weeks before, so people were very interested, and that panel included a number of people with lived experience, a number of people that would be the equivalent of what we're doing that are going out in the community. It included police, EMS, the health unit, the whole spectrum of people who have some part to play in substance use in the community, and that kind of approach needs to be taken so that it's comprehensive and everyone's at the table. Otherwise, it just gets pushed aside as that's not relevant to this group or vice versa.
Okay, so who's going to lead that then? Who's going to step up and organize that?
That's a really good question, Rob. We've been talking about it, and maybe it's
who's we when you say we've been talking.
Ed Greenwood Coalition, with some of the folks we connect with. We're part of a drug strategy group. Megan Damon leads that, and so that's probably where the direction could come from, because that the drug strategy group is kind of the loose connection of everyone who has something to do with.
And that's run also through the health unit as well.
Yeah, connected with the health unit, yeah. and so all of those services. That's the most comprehensive body.
But that's not to say Greenwood's not doing anything. I understand, Nicole, that there's an event coming up on Saturday, August 31st, International Overdose Awareness Day. Could you tell us a bit about that and what's going on?
Sure. From 8 till 1, we will be, we'll have a booth down at the farmer's market here in Coburg. And part of that is awareness for those that have been taken by overdose, but also a safe space for people to come, ask questions. We'll have some resource information there. We'll be doing Flags of Hope, which is memorial flags, can be done by anyone that has been affected by overdose loss. Not only that, but we will have naloxone kits available. And this year we'll be doing something a little different, and it's called Sidewalk Talk. So we're going to be inviting people to sit. We're going to be training. I'll be training active listeners next week, and just come down, be a part of community. Whether you're there because you need support, or maybe someone you know is in need of support. It should be a good community building event and awareness.
But that's not the only thing that's happening. I understand on Saturday, September the 14th, along with the Halliburton Kawartha Lakes Northumberland Drug Strategy, there's going to be something called Coburg Unity that you're involved with. Can you tell us more about that?
I'll jump in there, Rob, on that one. The Unity Project is a large scale art installation. Really, as you encounter it, it's a 40-foot circle that is created over the course of the day. The part that isn't as obvious from a distance is that that each spoke of the circle has an individual identifier, and so as a community member comes in, they might see an identifier that they can attach to themselves, like I'm a dog person, but it also might be an identifier like I've been homeless or I've used a food bank, and some of these more personal things that challenge things. I'm a newcomer to Canada, that type of thing, and as this develops and a web is created in this art piece, it's It demonstrates what a community looks like and what a community is made of, and some of those things. And so this is one of the challenges with community. We can walk around downtown, or we can walk around at a farmer's market and encounter people and not know their story, not know that we're connected. So this is an opportunity to kind of make that visual. We've done it a couple of times before. And so some of the folks that will be there will be folks like us that are working in this sector with folks that are struggling. But the whole approach is again building a better web of community that supports each of us, and that includes people who are struggling.
Sounds amazing. Sounds absolutely amazing. I want to thank both of you for being here today. Nicole, thank you for sharing your story. I know that's never easy, and we appreciate it very, very much. And David, as always, thank you for coming in and sharing with us as well.
Thanks,
I want to thank all of the listeners for tuning in today. Please join me again next week when we will be talking to people on the front lines and those behind the scenes who make a difference in your life and Northumberland County. So please tune in. The impact of opioids on people is never so real as when we hear stories from people who face the situation directly, or from family and friends of those who have either lost someone to an opioid overdose or are trying to help a person facing addiction to this drug. I'm interested in your stories. If you are willing to share your story, please feel free to go to my Facebook page or my own website. Find any appropriate place to comment and write freely, or you can email me directly at considerthisnorthumberland@gmail.com. We need to hear all the stories from many perspectives, and thank you. I would also like to thank all of you who have continued to write thoughtful, caring, and insightful comments to my posts of the last few interviews. Social media is not always a good place to debate issues, yet I am grateful to those who demonstrate that you can still have intelligent, considered, and caring discussions online. Thank you so much. If you have any comments, questions, rants, or raves, please email me at considerthisnorthumberland@gmail.com, or you can try my Facebook page, Consider This. Or if you're on Twitter, you can message me at rwash. I will read out a selection of comments on next week's show. If you'd like to listen or share this or any podcast, please check out my website at consider-this.ca. There you'll find past podcast news and other information about life and politics in Northumberland County. Or you can go to the radio station's website at northumberland897.ca. I'm Robert Washburn. Thanks for taking the time out of your busy day to listen in, and I hope over the next week you will continue to consider this.